Today is Wednesday, January 22nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington.
And I'm Jackson Vunganyi. Officials in China are racing to contain a deadly new strain of virus that has infected almost 450 people and left almost 20 dead.
We unfortunately feel confident that this is a much larger problem than the case numbers would give you today.
Also ahead, day two of the Senate impeachment trial of U.S. President Donald Trump. It's all on today's International Edition.
The U.S. Senate on Tuesday began proceedings in the impeachment trial of President Donald Trump. He's only the third U.S. president to face trial in the Senate. Earlier today at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Trump dismissed the case against him. Saga Megani with the Associated Press has more.
President Trump is heading home from an economic summit in Switzerland hours after the Senate wrapped up a marathon impeachment session. It took until near 2 o'clock this morning, but Senate Republicans have approved impeachment trial rules on their own terms, rejecting Democratic demands to immediately call witnesses. But that came after GOP Chief Mitch McConnell abruptly dropped plans to cram opening arguments into just 2 days, which Democrats had said would lead to sessions in the dead of night. At a surprise news conference in Davos, the president kept bashing them.
They had no case. It's all a hoax. It's a con job.
Even as he ripped the trial,
I'd sort of love to sit right in the front row and stare at their corrupt faces. I'd love to do it.
Sagar Meghani, Washington.
And to update us more on the Senate trial, VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson joins us by the phone. Hello, Catherine.
Hello.
So the impeachment trial went on late into the early morning, both sides making their cases to the senators who are the jurors in this case, but also, you know, effectively making the case to the American people. Talk to us about some of the tactics used, especially used by the defense to try and get witnesses, including Senator Schumer, the minority leader in the Senate, kept introducing amendments. How effective was that tactic?
Right. Well, on the face of it, Senator Schumer's tactics were completely unsuccessful. The entire U.S. Senate was in the chamber until 2 o'clock in the morning, voting down amendment after amendment that Senator Schumer was putting up in an attempt to bring witnesses and evidence into the impeachment trial. We, of course, know that he failed. But part of his underlying strategy is that he's bringing this issue to the attention of the American people as the impeachment trial is getting underway. He's saying, look, here are the Senate Republicans who are voting down these amendments, who are denying the opportunity for witnesses to testify in an impeachment trial. That would be unprecedented in an impeachment trial. He's really drawing attention to this issue in a way that perhaps hadn't been looked at before.
Okay, so as the trial enters its second day, how different will it be from yesterday? What should we be looking out for?
Right, so it'll be very different, actually. Yesterday, we had all of these procedural fights. We did hear the House impeachment managers coming to the Senate floor and arguing portions of the impeachment case. But today is when things really get started. Think of the opening arguments in a trial where the defense and the prosecution are making their cases to a panel of jurors. This is when the prosecution is going to go up there and put together all of the information that they've been gathering over these past few months about President Trump, and they're going to make the case that he abused the power of the presidency and then obstructed Congress's efforts to investigate that.
Right, and we should apologize to our listeners. The line is not that good. We have a little technical difficulties. But as we wrap this up, Catherine, the defense was expected to file a motion to dismiss this case altogether, but by deadline, they hadn't. And we saw that President Trump said earlier today that he would rather have a long trial with witnesses. Do we see a change of strategy by the White House here?
Well, you know, President Trump is going back and forth on the issue of witnesses. He will say that he wants, you know, Ambassador Bolton and Mick Mulvaney to testify, but then he'll give reasons for why they can't testify in an open setting. I think it's more important to look at Mitch McConnell's strategy here. He doesn't want to dismiss this case because he doesn't want Republicans to look like they're obstructing this case. He wants it to play itself out but under his rules and on his timeline.
That was VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson joining us by the phone. Thanks, Catherine.
Thank you.
Trump wrapped up his trip to the World Economic Forum in Davos with a series of bilateral meetings, primarily focused on trade. He threatened to impose crippling tariffs on European autos unless the EU budges on a long-delayed deal. Washington also took aim at European nations that are introducing a digital services tax against U.S. technology giants such as Amazon, Facebook, and Google, which stand accused of depriving governments of a fair share of their mammoth cross-border profits. France's foreign minister said his country will delay imposing its tax on cross-border digital commerce, which the U.S. has opposed. However, Bruno Le Maire said Paris will not scrap the tax without an international agreement on taxing giant digital corporations.
And still at Davos Wednesday, U.S. President Donald Trump said that the White House plans to expand its list of countries whose citizens are banned from traveling to the United States.
No, we are. We're adding a couple of countries to it. We have to be safe. Our country has to be safe. You see what's going on in the world. Our country has to be safe. So we have a very strong travel ban, and we'll be adding a few countries to it.
Could you give us a hint about the region or the country?
Well, it's going to be announced very shortly.
While Trump did not elaborate, news media have reported that the preliminary plan would add 7 countries to the list. The Wall Street Journal newspaper reported the list includes Belarus, Eritrea, Kazakhstan, Myanmar, Nigeria, Sudan, and Tanzania. Actually, that country is Kyrgyzstan. The current travel bans include Iran, Libya, Somalia, Syria, and Yemen, as well as Venezuela and North Korea. The countries on the proposed expansion list includes allies that fall short on certain security measures. VOA's International Edition continues among the top stories. The lower house of Britain's parliament on Wednesday overturned changes made by the upper house to the legislation needed to ratify the country's divorce agreement with the European Union. Prime Minister Boris Johnson has signaled that he will not accept any changes to the withdrawal agreement bill, which will enact Britain's departure from the EU on January the 31st. And in South Sudan, local authorities in the disputed Abyei border region say that Misriya tribesmen had killed at least 29 people in an attack on a village. The status of Abyei was supposed to have been resolved via referendum after a 2005 peace agreement that preceded South Sudan's 2011 secession from Sudan. But the vote has never been held. And in Bolivia, the country's Congress formally accepted the November resignation of former leader Evo Morales and his deputy Alvaro Garcia Linera, marking the end of his 14-year socialist administration as the South American country heads for new elections in May.
Chinese health authorities urged people in the city of Wuhan to avoid crowds and public gatherings after warning that a new viral illness that has infected more than 400 people and killed at least 17 could spread further. The appeal came as the World Health Organization convened a group of independent experts to advise whether the outbreak should be declared a global emergency. Cases have been found in China, Thailand, Japan, South Korea, Hong Kong, Macau, and the United States. Gao Fu, head of the Chinese Center for Disease Control and Prevention, said Wednesday that officials are working on the assumption that the outbreak resulted from human exposure to wild animals sold illegally at a market in Wuhan. Previous coronavirus outbreaks were also linked to animal sources. SARS transmitted to humans from civets, a cat-like carnivore, while MERS jumped from camels. To learn more about how the latest coronavirus may have jumped from animals to humans and how it could spread further, I spoke today with Dr. Michael Osterholm, the director of the Center of Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota in Minneapolis.
Well, first of all, the animal viruses of the world are constantly pinging humans almost all the time. In particularly those that involve domesticated animals and or food source animals, wild animals that we hunt for food. In the process of handling the animals, handling their body fluids, slaughtering the animals, getting blood, other body fluids in contact with humans, means that every time that happens, it's just one more opportunity for a virus that may be naturally adapted to an animal species becoming more adapted to humans. In the case of coronavirus, that's clearly the case. We know that they can cross over to humans, and with sufficient exposure and ongoing genetic changes or mutations in the virus in the natural reservoir, the animal species they're in, occasionally the absolute worst combination occurs where a virus that can infect humans is in an animal that has human contact with that animal, and then you have the jump from animals to humans.
And now there's even reports that it seems like this disease can jump from human to human.
Not jumping. Once a virus is adapted to humans, meaning that it now can infect humans, in this case with coronaviruses, that often also infers that it can also be transmitted by humans. And when you get the combination of the two, that is all the makings of a human-transmitted disease. So in some ways, the animal almost becomes irrelevant. Because now it's sustained by human-human transmission, and that's what we see here. Now, it is still important to understand what the reservoir is, because in SARS, for example, we were able to get rid of all the palm civets in the market areas of Guangdong province, which in a sense shut off the faucet of new viruses entering into the human world. With MERS, we've not been able to do that, because the natural reservoir are camels. With 14 million camels in the world, we're not going to suddenly exterminate all of them. And the virus continues to be transmitted within the camel population and occasionally spilling over into those who have close contact with it. This particular situation in Wuhan, we don't know what we have. Was this an isolated event where it jumped from animals to humans and then all of the transmission from here on out will be human to human? Or do we have a combination? Do we have ongoing pings from the animal world into humans and that faucet's not shut off yet, as well as human-to-human transmission?
So what should governments be doing now to be reducing the risk of transmission and shutting this down?
So the animal reservoir, we need to understand much more about what the likely source was. We want to be very careful about just saying this all started at one market in Wuhan, the seafood market, but look at the animal species that may have been the source for the virus in the first instance and make sure throughout all the food system of that area of China that animal is no longer part of it. But I think that the more dynamic and really major concern shutdown that we need to deal with is that around human-to-human transmission. And we have seen with the outbreak of SARS in 2003, we've seen it with the MERS outbreaks that have occurred, particularly a good example in Asia is the MERS outbreak that occurred at Samsung Medical Center several years ago, where a single patient who came back from the Middle East was infected with the virus, was in the emergency room at Samsung on several occasions, and transmitted more than 80 people. And that was what we call a super spreader, someone who was highly infectious. The person themselves were not that severely ill. And that's the kind of concern we have to have today.
So far it's been in China, in Hong Kong, and the U.S., you know, countries that have more or less developed healthcare systems. What are the risks if this spreads to countries with much less developed healthcare systems?
Well, first of all, I will be so bold to say it already has. Remember, anytime we pick up a case and we document that case, these are days after the exposure occurred. You know, on average, it takes about 7 days for someone to get clinically ill with a coronavirus infection following exposure. Then by the time they get sufficiently ill to actually go to see a healthcare provider, and then they actually have the right test methods to be able to use in that hospital or clinic or government laboratory, takes additional days. Just take a look at the United States. It took almost a week. We have to be mindful that we're always going to be looking at the rearview mirror when we talk about new cases in different countries. And I would, again, unfortunately, feel comfortable suggesting this has already been widespread through a number of countries in the world. 10 days from now, we can talk about what happened today. This is a much larger problem than the case numbers would give you today.
That was Dr. Michael Osterholm, the director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota.
In Hong Kong, where memories of the deadly SARS outbreak in 2003 are strong, employees at Dragon Air, a Hong Kong airline, called for a halt to flights to Wuhan, the center of the outbreak. Meanwhile, in the U.S., the Center for Disease Control says that it has confirmed its first case of the coronavirus. Health officials said the United States will be more strict about health screenings of airplane passengers arriving from Wuhan. San Francisco International Airport official Doug Yakel tells the AP the Center for Disease Control has a system in place to identify possible virus carriers.
Passengers that are coming from Wuhan on board are being distributed a questionnaire, and that questionnaire is then turned in to CDC staff upon arrival at the airport. Those passengers are being diverted into a separate area inside the customs facility where they're being interviewed and evaluated.
The patient, who is not being named, is in isolation at Providence Regional Medical Center in Everett, Washington. He had recently returned from Wuhan. Yakel says the CDC is collecting information from travelers arriving from Wuhan. Violence flared Wednesday around Baghdad's Tahrir Square, where protesters have dug in behind barricades demanding sweeping government reforms. The protesters show no signs of leaving, although hundreds have died in the months of protests, and despite the heightened tensions in Iraq between U.S. and Iranian proxies. The demonstrations may grow even larger this Friday, when Iraqi Shia cleric Muqtada al-Sadr is set to give a speech demanding U.S. troops leave the Middle Eastern nation. To find out more, I spoke with VOA correspondent Heather Murdoch, who had just returned from the front lines of the Baghdad protest camp.
There was some violence last night and the night before. A few people have died. Many people have been injured. The Red Cross tells us that they still get injuries every single day from the front lines of the protests. We were up near the front lines of the protests today. And while at that point it was fairly small, like there was a bunch of young people singing and chanting, you could still hear gunfire in the distance, and they pointed out snipers on roofs not far away from us. There were tires burning, and some roads were blocked with sort of makeshift barricades, either of burnt out cars or cinder blocks, as well as burning tires.
So clearly, these protests aren't slowing down despite the big changes that have taken place, or the big events that have taken place between Iran and the U.S. on Iraqi soil.
The protests this year, earlier this year, it seemed like maybe they were getting smaller because we were so concerned with the news between America and Iran, and in some ways that just took our attention away from it, because actually this protest is like a whole town inside of Baghdad. They've shut down roads, businesses, and literally the protesters took over the town. The security is on the other side of barricades. So ending a protest would be, crushing a small town. So the protesters themselves are very unlikely to get tired and just go home at any time. And everyone anticipates on Friday for there to be mass demonstrations that are not only going to be or expected to be not diminished by the quarrel between the U.S. and Iran, but possibly much larger. A prominent Shiite cleric and leader, Muqtada al-Sadr, has called on people to come to the streets to protest U.S. military presence in Iraq on Friday, and there are a lot of people expected to come. We've spoken to protesters inside who live inside the camps in Tahrir Square and the surrounding area, and there seem to be of two separate minds. So some will say that it's actually two separate protests. Those protests that are calling for the U.S. military to leave Iraq is a completely separate issue from the issue of the core protesters in Tahrir Square that are asking for things like jobs, security, health care, an end to corruption, an end to extreme poverty, basic human rights issues. However, we also met a lot of protesters that believe in both and say they will come out to protest for their core concerns, which again are basic human rights. But since those who support Sadr will follow his word, they say, well, we'll also raise our voice in support of him as well.
Now, is this a case of the protest, the demands of the protests expanding to include other viewpoints and other demands, or is this perhaps a sign of divisions within Iraqi society that, as we've seen in the past, could turn quite violent or sectarian?
I mean, it's possible that it is. It's an expanding demand, but I think it's more likely that it is going to result and is already resulting in more divisionism, even among Shiite Muslims in Iraq, which are the majority. Not all support Sadr and support this particular idea, although he is very powerful and there hasn't been a strong voice against him. And to be fair, even people who do not want the U.S. military to leave by any means aren't necessarily thrilled by the fact that the U.S. military is present, so present in this country. But in terms of divisionism on a larger scale, the Sunni and the Kurds, which are the two largest minority parties, Iraq is primarily Shiite, Sunni, and Kurdish. They have taken a stance against the call for the U.S. military to leave, saying it's not a good idea for Iraq.
So what do you expect to see in the days ahead, or what are you going to be looking out for?
Well, on Friday particularly, I'm concerned that there will be violence. There has been violence when nothing specific was going on here on a regular basis. Protesters say at least 600 people have died since October in clashes with security forces. And with such a volatile issue on the table, it plays into the differences between support for Iran and support for the U.S. It plays into the differences between the religions and ethnicities of Iraqis. It plays into the differences between even those of the same religion and the same ethnicity. And in such a volatile place with so many weapons and so many armed groups concerned that it won't be a very safe day, I would be very surprised if it doesn't turn into, at the very least, a large mass rally.
That was VOA's Heather Murdoch in Baghdad. VOA's International Edition continues.
VOA's Our Voices television program is about more than just sitting and talking about women's issues. It's about listening to them and bringing their opinions to the table and making sure that their voices are heard. Because our lived experiences, our stories, and our voices will help shape the next generation.
Check your local TV listings and join the conversation each week with Our Voices on VOA.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, sub-Saharan African nations continue to struggle with their anti-corruption efforts. Corruption on the continent, on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
The United Nations is calling for an immediate investigation by the United States government into information that suggests that Amazon owner Jeff Bezos' phone was hacked by Saudi Arabia. The UN experts reviewed a 2019 digital forensics analysis of Bezos' iPhone, which was made available to them as UN special rapporteurs. Mike Hempman with the Associated Press has more.
United Nations experts are calling for the U.S. and others to investigate information suggesting Amazon founder Jeff Bezos' phone may have been hacked. The experts reviewed a digital forensic analysis of Bezos' iPhone and say it was hacked in May 2018 after it received an MP4 video file sent from the WhatsApp account of Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. The experts say Saudi Arabia was waging a massive online campaign against Bezos and Amazon, targeting him principally as the owner of the Washington Post. At the time, Saudi Arabia supposedly was investigating the killing of Saudi critic and Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi. I'm Mike Hempen.
The Financial Times has seen the forensic report that was done by a private firm Bezos hired. The newspaper said that the report does not claim to have conclusive evidence and could not ascertain what alleged spyware was used. The Saudi foreign minister on Wednesday called the report absurd.
Security forces in Lebanese capital Beirut fired water cannon and tear gas at angry protesters outside Parliament Wednesday, where a new government was being formed. And in Burkina Faso, the parliament has voted to provide local volunteers with, quote, light weapons, end quote, after the latest terror attack on two villages left 36 civilians dead. You've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Nadia Taha, our engineer, PJ Elliott, and my co-host, Jackson Mungani. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Have a great evening.